I was, His Excellency was hoping that I would talk about another Eliot poet with you. And Love Song, J. Elton Prufrock. I'll be glad to do that sometime. In fact, I promised to talk a bit about it before I get away. But I said to him, my head is just filled with Dante, because I've been invited to speak on Dante it's a musical term. It'll be a relatively slow talk, but, at the Dietrich von Hildebrand Institute that John Rau supervises in Leitgarde, Italy in July, which was a wonderful invitation for a couple of reasons. I had wanted to get back to Dante, if you will, and this provided the opportunity. So actually, part of what I'd like to talk about tonight is not so much the subject itself, but I would like to give you a pathway as to how I have wound up going to give these lectures and what I've discovered in the process, which tells you, I think, something that is of some interest about education and the way it works, what's going on currently, what many of the problems are. When I was here in April, I spoke a bit about the difficulty of reading Eliot's The Wasteland, and one of the difficulties being the fact that Eliot was a highly educated and very learned gentleman who had, oh, I see. This is what happens when you get informal. I'm missing the microphone. I'll back up a bit. I'll back up a bit and shout. And that for most of us to attempt to read The Wasteland, we find ourselves seriously intimidated. And of course, one of the things that Eliot knew very well was Dante and all of his poetry, from the beginning of his career as a poet to the very last poems, just loaded with references, either direct or indirect, to this greatest of all Italian poets, and in some ways the great Catholic poet. Eliot said at one point, and it's one of my favorite lines by Eliot, Dante and Shakespeare divide the world between them. There is no third. And it's an astonishing thing to say, and having spent the last few months working my way through the Divine Comedy again, at the same time that I was teaching some Shakespeare, I am convinced of it, absolutely convinced of it. These two men in the sphere of literature just loom above all others. As a result, they are deserving of our study. They're deserving of time being spent with them. Shakespeare is lucky in one sense. Part of it, I think, has to do with the fact that he came 300 years later. If it's easy, just to keep the date straight, Dante sets the Divine Comedy in the year 1300. It begins on Good Friday in the year 1300. Chaucer dies in 1400. Shakespeare writes Hamlet in 1601, but it's close enough, so you can sort of get that sense of a sequence there. So Shakespeare comes about 300 years after Dante. As a result, he had a foot in the modern world. If Dante was a poet who writes this extraordinary epic poem about this voyage through the afterlife, Shakespeare is a dramatist. And the drama comes about because he had two different worldviews clashing that produce drama. Drama always being conflict, and the man lived in a time that was nothing but conflict. But because he was partially modern, because he wrote in a Protestant nation, because he had to veil much of his own thinking, because it was not in it would have probably meant the end of his career and the end of his social and worldly ambitions if he'd been public about his own beliefs, which I don't think were not overtly Catholic till near the end of his life, at least in his writings. He was a great poet of doubt, but Christian doubt, and it's the reason his greatest works are the tragedies, because he is examining the problem of doubt that was going to afflict the modern world. It's there in the tragedies. As a result, the modern world will still study him. He remains popular. There is enough of what we think that he gets some sanction, although it's becoming, I think, more and more evident to more and more academics and those in charge of the schools that he's still too dangerous and they're trying to get rid of him. There is a massive assault going on right now on Shakespeare. He is one of the last links with literary tradition. Dante is a name. Educated people are aware of him. Very few have read him. They sort of know what he did. They know something about the poetry. If they've read anything at all, they've read the Inferno and stopped there. And there are reasons for that. But the fact of the matter is, he is not known. I found myself in graduate school working on my doctorate, about to begin teaching, before I had read a word of Dante. This means I had gone through 13 years in public schools, 4 years as an undergraduate, literature major, University of Minnesota, and had not read one word of Dante. Simply wasn't given to me. Again, I had a sense of the name. I vaguely knew what it was about. I knew nothing about it. Absolutely nothing about it. What happened was, I was going to teach my first class. It was at Indiana University. And there was a large lecture section that a professor would give, and those of us who were teaching assistants would then have two other classes with smaller groups. They would break down the large lecture section into smaller discussion sections, and we would teach those smaller sections. I was very excited. I was finally going to get to teach literature after having studied it for, well, many years. And I met the professor who was doing the large lectures. And again, this is typical. There was not a uniform course of study. Each professor selected what the subject of that course would be for the semester. Went in, and there was this very peculiar man sitting in this office. And it was going to be the modern rock lyric. I was horrified. He gave me a stack of records and told me to go. My job was to go home and take the lyrics off the records. Couldn't do it. Part of my hatred of rock music comes from that. I spent hours and hours, and they weren't even some of the halfway decent ones. I was listening to groups like Stone Ground and Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen and Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks over and over and over again, trying to transcribe the lyrics. It was an absolute nightmare. This lasted for about 3 weeks, and I realized I was cheating the students. I hated what I was doing. And I simply announced in my discussion sections that they could do whatever they wanted in relation to the lecture. But I was going to do a course on modern poetry and not the modern rock lyric. And so we began studying Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot and Yeats. And it was while I was reading Pound and Eliot, I began to realize that Dante was hugely important, and suddenly realized this was something I needed to do. And then I discovered for the next semester, I was teaching with a man who was going to do a course in the epic. And he was including the Inferno, and I finally had to read the Inferno. So that I did not get my introduction to Dante until my second year of postgraduate work. And then it was a fluke, because I happened to be assigned to a professor who was going to do a course in the epic, who happened to include it. It was stunning. It was stunning. It was overwhelming. And I then realized I had to go on and read the rest of this, worked my way through it, mystified. And at that point, This was before I had converted to Catholicism. This was at a time when I knew virtually nothing about the Catholic faith, other than all of those old stories that I had been given as a young Protestant, all the horror stories about Catholics never read the Bible, and you know, they worship graven images and just all sorts of peculiar things. So I even missed much of what was going on in the Inferno. And I have to say this, and this is also what's going on out there. Nevertheless, I was being allowed to teach something that I quite obviously didn't know or understand. They paid me to do it. And even worse, young people paid to go to the university to have me teach them something that I didn't know. And that was 23 years ago, 24 years ago. It's worse now. It's worse now. I at least made an effort and had, you know, was serious about what I was doing. But I went through and then read the rest of the Divine Comedy and was absolutely baffled by it. Didn't understand it at all. I reread it after my conversion. And what I found most interesting, coming to it as a new Catholic, having just been through instruction in the faith from a wonderful old Irish Monsignor. I was very lucky to have good instruction in the faith. When I read it the second time, I was entranced by the Purgatorio and got a sense for the first time of what that whole doctrine of purgatory was about. And it's very interesting. I think in certain ways, Dante's vision of purgatory is a fascinating lesson for Catholics. It helps explain things that often remain an interesting idea, but that we cannot fully understand. I'll come back to that in a moment. But I was baffled by the Paradiso. Interesting, but really didn't understand it. I read it again then, a few years back, went through some commentaries, and got a sense of the completeness of it, and I put in to teach a course at the Naval Academy on Dante, because I'd been doing the reading, and now I was at the point where teaching the course would help me clarify my thoughts. I was now ready to teach it. And what happened was the course was rejected in favor of a course on modern Afro-American female writers. and I was very upset, not as upset as the students who were hoping that they would get a chance to study Dante, but as a result didn't. But it was shortly thereafter that the offer came to go and give these lectures at the von Hildebrand Institute. So it gave me a chance to start putting my thoughts down and looking at the poem. I did something, however, and it's very curious. Something that I did in graduate school that I hadn't done since. I decided I would go to the library and read the great commentaries. Okay? Because most of the work I had done had just been my own reading and my own thoughts, and with some guidance along the way. But basically, I went to the library and was absolutely overwhelmed with the volumes of material, and began to realize Dante really is a world unto himself. And given the fact that he has been around for so long, given the greatness of the poem, almost anything you bring toward the poem lights up. So that I began having to sort through some of the commentaries and realizing much of what's written is simply crazy, and yet they can write it because the poem is so gigantic and all-inclusive. It's also an enormous playground for them to play on. You can bring your favorite game there and find a space to play it, and many of them do. So you get your Freudian Dante and your Marxist Dante and your feminist Dante and your deacon. You know, all of the modern games are there. But the thing that struck me the most was that
the very volume of writing on the poem itself discourages the reading of it. And I had this moment, and I think anyone setting out to read a major writer has to be aware of this, of simply feeling overwhelmed, even though I'd been through the poem a number of times. I'd studied it. I knew a good bit about it. I had my own ideas about it. I was ready to just give up and say, I can't do it. I can't talk about this. There's just, I can't take all this in. I don't have the insights that these great scholars have. And in a way, it's what modern scholarship is all about. It's to overwhelm you, frighten you, and put you off, to turn you back, and give you the sense that your knowledge is so small, your ability to take all this in, you simply don't have the time, you don't have the energy, and therefore, let it alone. Just let it alone, I can never know it. The point I'm making here, they've got you coming and going. They won't teach it to you. They don't want you to know it. Basically, we're talking one of the giants. If we begin and just start talking about the great poets, we've got Homer, we've got Virgil, and then boom, there's Dante. I mean, in terms of over from the dawn of time, these are the major figures. And yet, not being taught. Nobody taught me Virgil. I never read Homer. I was given none of this. Again, I've done it on my own. Was not taught it. It is not likely you can go through and educate the educational process now and get any exposure to this. You decide, I'm going to read it on my own. It is an overwhelming poem. It is a poem that is now 700 years old, that is clearly set in a time period. The historical nature of it is extremely important. You have to have some sense of the background and what was going on. It is overwhelming in terms of its theology. Obviously, it's the subject of the poem. It is the central work, the central poetic work, the central poetic image for the Middle Ages. There it is. So that in a way, it's a summation of medieval thought in poetic form. It's also a personal vision. It's one man's journey through these three spheres of the afterlife, and an inward journey. It's why the psychologists can have a wonderful time with the poem. But you begin trying to explore any of this, you go to get help, and here are 40 shelves of books. At which point, again, you're reluctant to do it on your own. My point is this, don't be afraid of it. This is something you must read. You must read. I've been absolutely overwhelmed since going through it again and having it in my brain, and I talk about it to everybody I bump into. Nobody's read it. People don't know it. And I don't care what circle I'm moving in. Students, obviously not. They haven't been given it. My colleagues, obviously not. They all got PhDs as well. They never had to read it. They don't know it. I talk to many Catholics, and I find that in Catholic circles, it's not read. People who study poetry, it's not read. And yet, this is one of the major figures. This is one of those figures who's been buried. This is a man who's been buried. But he's been buried alive. This poem lives. And it does. All you have to do is take a little spoonful of the dirt off it, and it comes springing back to life. It's essential reading. It's essential reading. The first thing I want to do is encourage you at some point to read the poem. And all three of the canticles, if you will, okay? It is a complete, it's 100 cantos. It's long. It's not difficult reading. Much of it is obscure. There is an enormous cast of characters, hundreds and hundreds of figures that he meets. It can be off-putting because you don't know many of them. And it's one of those poems where the footnotes can kill it. And what you can't do is, well, now who's Farinata? Well, I got to look ahead and I read them. By which point, you've lost the flow of the poem. These things you can pick up later. Just read it. Just read it. The footnotes are there for later. You'll begin to get a sense of who some of these figures are. But the most important thing to keep in mind is that this was a poem, and it was the first great poem written in the vernacular. Dante began his career writing Latin verse. It's what an educated poet did. When he came to write the Divine Comedy, he went through a debate as whether or not to write this in scholarly verse or in Italian. He chose to write it in the vernacular, which means he was writing it for an audience who could read it. He did not mean for it to be intellectually intimidating. He meant for it to be read, and I would say that is still the case, even though 700 years have now gone by. You can still read it. You need to find a decent translation. There are some out there. If you have a little knowledge of Italian, it's easy enough to find the original and just get some sense of the music of the verse. The problem with poetry is that it's very difficult to pick up the intricacies of language and the wonderful richness of the language unless you know that language very well. But what you can get a sense of is some of the music of the verse, what it sounds like. Because the sounds are glorious. Dante was a great musician, and he will give you that. But even more importantly, as you go through it, a sense of the truth the man is telling. The vision is an extraordinary vision. It is a thoroughly Catholic vision. And that is the reason why it's gone. It's gone, and you're not going to find it. And you've not read it. It's because it is unequivocal. It's Catholic. And it is loaded with Catholic theology. I can think of a few better ways to get the faith to intelligent young people than sit them down with it and go through it with them line by line, canto by canto. And not to berate them, but just with the sense of awe and wonder of what is being explored and the way in which it's being discussed and the shaping, the extraordinary shaping vision that the man has, and making it a personal journey. Because reading the poem, and again, it's the reason it's in the vernacular, it's the reason Virgil may lead Dante through the Inferno and the Purgatorio, and Beatrice lead him through the Paradiso. The fact of the matter is Dante is leading us through all three. He takes us by the hand and he leads us through. It is an extraordinary poem, and it must be read. Something sprang to my mind, and this is the other thing. The great Catholic prose work isn't read. Nobody knows it. And it was wonderful getting to chat about it at the picnic this afternoon, and that's Cervantes' Don Quixote. Everyone knows it's a masterpiece. Everybody's heard of the character. Everyone has sort of a vision of this madman and Sancho Panza and all of that. But nobody's read the book. Nobody's read the book. Never had to read a word of it. And I remember when I finally sat down and read the thing, was absolutely overwhelmed by it and began talking to people about nobody had read it. And the reason nobody had read it is because it's Catholic. The fact of the matter is our Catholic literary heritage has been jettisoned. It's been taken away. And they will acknowledge, you can pick up the most wacko, liberal piece of criticism, and they will praise Dante, and they will praise Cervantes, and they can get away with it because they know nobody's reading these guys. And that your knowledge of them is coming through their praise. And if you sat them down and asked them a couple of questions, you'd discover they've never read it. They're just praising it because they once had teachers who praised it. I am convinced the whole game is a game of intimidation to scare you away from reading these things. They're great. They're overwhelming. Don't touch them. Don't go near them. I never did it. Ooh, I don't think I would need 40 reading guides, and I need somebody to teach it to me. I can't. Therefore, nonsense. You've got a brain. You've got eyes. These were writers who wrote for good Catholic readers, and boom, there it is. They make some demands. Quixote's 800 60 pages long, 940 pages long, depending on the translation. But it's the most delightful book ever written. You will laugh till your sides ache. Ache. It's the funniest book ever written. There's a reason why it was, for many years, a kid's book. The young Dickens discovering the pile of books in the attic of the house his parents had rented and going up there and reading Robinson Crusoe and the Arabian Nights and Don Quixote. You had a 7-year-old, 8-year-old who was reading the book and learning to write novels from it. He had no reader's guide. He had no teacher. Okay? A 7-year-old kid, admittedly bright, but a 7-year-old kid can do it. There's no need for us to be intimidated by this. You do need a little time. That's tough. But the other thing is, don't be overwhelmed. There are times when it seems as if there's just all this stuff out there to read, and you'll never read it all. There is a lot out there to be read, but the fact of the matter is there are certain things that you must read. The great Catholic poet, Dante, you must read him. The great Catholic prose writer, the great Catholic novelist, Cervantes, you've got to read Quixote. And you need to read Shakespeare. I mean, you've got to read the giants. There's a reason they're giants, and there's a reason why they're being kept from you. And you're being discouraged from reading them. That means that they'll do you some good. They're also wonderfully, wonderfully entertaining. I don't really want to do as kind of... Sometime if I'm invited back, I'd love to sort of go through the full Divine Comedy with you. But before I do that, I would really like you to have dabbled in it a bit.
Certainly.
That's a wonderful idea. Let me make one suggestion. Here's another curiosity. I've been comparing translations in English. I've read through about 6 to 8 different English translations. Some of which are awful. Those are the ones most highly praised by the academic community, including, and I said, this is shocking, I just bought a new edition of the Inferno. Just came out. It's getting rave reviews. A new translation by a highly acclaimed poet that is the most unpoetic, flat, dead, awful thing I have ever read. But what's most frightening is most of those praising it are other highly acclaimed modern poets. They have no ear. They have no ear. They don't know music. He misses entirely the sound, the beauty. It's gone. There are some translations that are competent, that are okay. There's one in English that's not just readable, but actually gets to the core of ideas, thought, and captures some of the beauty. It's the Penguin paperback series, and the translator's name is Mark Musa, M-U-S-A, Mark Musa. Don't launch into it in any other translation. It is an extraordinarily fine piece of work. It's readable. While I'm on the subject, if you want to read Don Quixote, there is only one. With the Divine Comedy, there are a couple of others that are readable. There's a John Ciardi translation that's quite good, and a wonderful Catholic lady who taught at Oxford for many years named Dorothy Sayers, who's best known for a series of murder mysteries, the Lord Peter Wimsey detective novels, has a Dante translation. She goes for the rhyme. The ones that go for the rhyme get in trouble, but it's okay. Her introductions are wonderful. Her introductions are very fine. But with Quixote, there's only one. And again, it's simply a matter of comparing translations. It's also a Penguin paperback, and the translator's name is Cohen, J.M. Cohen. He gets the jokes. There's an old saying in comedy that comedy is all timing. And if that's true, it's true in prose and poetry as well. You've got to write the joke. You've got to tell the joke right, or it's not funny. And most of the other translators don't know how to tell a joke. And the humor just goes... And if you take the humor out of Quixote, you've lost the book. Cohen can tell a joke, and he captures... He's got the rhythms there. and it's a wonderfully funny, readable translation. But I was interested as well. I've had a number of you come up to me today and say that you've been reading Flannery O'Connor since I dropped the name. The lady's a giant, and I'm not joking. I will breathe her name along with Cervantes and Dante. She is that good. Hands down the greatest American writer of the century, and thoroughly Catholic, which means she's going to last. When you have that much talent and that much good Catholic sense, God touched her with genius. He also took her home right when she started reading Teilhard de Chardin. She started to get interested in Chardin, and God took her home. It was great, great mercy. But I would love to, in the future, since a number of you have been reading O'Connor, I'd love to go through a couple of those stories with you, because they have a richness and complexity that are unrivaled in modern literature. She is something. She is really something. So that's my little informal talk. Let me take questions tonight. But a couple of things. Don't be intimidated by this stuff, okay? Because I know what that's like. I just had a bad bout of it recently, and it can overwhelm you. And the reason it's set up that way is to keep you from reading it. Nonsense. You've got eyes. You've got a good brain. Sit down, read it. You can do it. And the other thing is that there are certain authors you just must read. If you're going to be Catholic priest, then you must know the great Catholic writers. And that includes the great Catholic artists. And Dante and Cervantes and Shakespeare, O'Connor. If you know the giants, if you know the big ones, you're well on your way. And there are also good things to keep close to you. I guarantee you, once you get out in the world, given what's going on out there, it would be very good to have a copy of Quixote by your side to brighten some of those days that will get pretty dark. Or to be able to read a canto of the Paradiso and keep in mind what it's all about. Clarity of thought, brilliance of vision, and that sense of the fact there may be times that it seems like we're stuck in a quagmire. It may seem like we're in the river of blood in the inferno, but the fact of the matter is we're on a pilgrimage. And we're moving upward. We should be moving upward. It's our job to keep moving upward. And that's important. Let me take some questions.
Was there conscious or unconscious of a mission when you were here last time? You mentioned great American authors and books, Huckleberry Finn. I know Mark Twain wasn't exactly, the greatest in Catholic viewpoints in some ways, but would you put Huckleberry Finn as one of the great American novels?
I would have to, yes, but with this caveat. I think Huckleberry Finn is one of those books that has to be read when you're young. It is a wonderful children's book, which is when it should be read. My problem with Huckleberry Finn is that it is flawed as a work of art. The ending is awful. The book falls to pieces two-thirds of the way through. Twain didn't know how to end it, wasn't sure what to do with it. So you have this book that has glorious moments in it, pages as good as anything any American ever wrote. But it is not a complete whole in any way. It falls apart. I have some real problems with it. I would advise anybody to read it, but I'd have them read it when they're young. It's a tough book to go back to when you're older and have developed some critical sense, because the holes in it become that much more obvious. In some ways, I'm fonder of Tom Sawyer. It seems to me artistically richer and a more perfect artistic work. It doesn't have the highs of Huck Finn at its best. But and at the same time, I'm just dubious of Twain. I saw downstairs in the bookstore. I don't want to come here as your guest and be rude, but I saw downstairs in the bookstore the Mark Twain Joan of Arc.
I defy anybody to read that book. It is the naughty twain trying to be a nice guy. It is so saccharine.
Oh.
It's so insipid. It's, oh boy. I nearly had an accident when I walked by and saw it there. That was really, oh, ouch. What that is a man without faith trying to be pious. And I don't think it works at all. Twain's an interesting writer and somebody that's worth knowing. But I got my problems with him. Not my problems there, yeah. Oh, he becomes increasingly anti-Catholic. The last works, the Letters from the Earth, the final volumes that the family suppressed with good reason, are horrendously anti-Catholic. But what happened is Twain was hit with what happens to all great satirists as they grow older. They become bitter, cynical men. And he took much of that anger and leveled it against the church and against himself. Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned that we're trying to take Dante into verse, where the pronouns are readers now.
Rhyme. Oh, rhyme. Here's the problem. Let me illustrate it this way. You've probably heard of the sonnet, the 14-line poem, that usually a love lyric. The sonnet comes from Italy. The sonnet devised in Italy by Petrarch some years after Dante. And the sonnet in Italian has five sets of rhymes. Okay? The sonnet moves to England, what we call the Shakespearean sonnet, and Shakespeare gives himself seven sets of rhyming words. Not because he wasn't smart, wasn't a good poet, but from the simple fact it is much more difficult to rhyme in English than in Italian or French or Spanish. It's simply much tougher. The common endings of words in the Romance languages makes it much easier to rhyme them. We don't have that in English. As a result, to rhyme in English, you got your work cut out for you. So that when an English poet attempts to do Dante in rhyme, you're embarking on a dangerous course. It's not as easy. There are fewer possibilities. And what they inevitably end up doing is altering the sense slightly in order to hit a rhyme. And as a result, they will often do some major rewriting just so they can get that rhyme right. And of course, the other problem is, I don't know if you know, it's a wonderful rhyming scheme that the Divine Comedy has written. It's called Terza Rima. Each canto, a series of three-line verses. But they are linked. So that the rhymes go, if we begin at the beginning of a canto, we've got a little three-line unit that rhymes ABA, which means the first line and the third line rhyme. We move to the second little verse. It rhymes BCB. So that the second line of the first stanza rhymes with lines 1 and 3 of the next stanza. Okay? ABA, BCB. And it keeps going on that way. So that the third stanza is CDC. Fourth stanza, DED. So what you get are all these interlocking stanzas. The reason he does this is once you get the sense of that rhyme, it pulls you through the canto. Those rhymes just pull you forward because you're always aware, even if you've finished a stanza, you haven't finished the rhyme. The rhyme won't be completed until the middle of the next stanza, by which time you have another set of rhymes that are going to move you forward into the next stanza. And one of the real problems in reading Dante is that the pace just keeps going like this, and you're just whoosh. He's doing that deliberately. It sets this wonderful tempo. It gives this. Now, the beauty of that is the poem is constructed. We have the three grand sections, the Inferno, the Purgatory, Paradise, threes. we've got the three-line stanzas in which the whole poem is written in little groups of threes. We've got the rhymes. Every word is rhymed three times. There's only one word in the poem that is its own rhyme when it occurs. Whenever Christ's name appears, it only rhymes with itself, which is a wonderful touch, wonderful touch. And as we move through the poem, the Inferno, the Purgatorio, the Paradiso, each section is broken into three. There is a kind of, what would I call it? An anteroom. We get a little introductory section where we move through a section of the Inferno. At the beginning, it's limbo in the first few circles, and then we descend into the pits of hell. There's the anti-purgatory. There are those souls who repented at the last moment and as a result have to wait. They can't even begin the climb up Mount Purgatory until they have spent a sufficient span of time equal to the time they spent on earth before they finally saw the light and repented. And they're all just hanging around at the bottom of the mountain, knowing that they're going to make their journey. Eventually they'll be going up there. Everybody else, you know, everybody's moving up, but they're just, you know, it's a waiting room. And in the Paradiso, you get very much the same sort of thing. We begin and get the first few spheres as we ascend upward that make a little group. Then there is the big central section, and then a sort of penultimate section. In the Inferno, we descend into the pit of hell and see Satan. In the Purgatorio, we come to the top of Mount Purgatory, and what do we find there? The earthly paradise. We're back in the garden where Adam and Eve were. We come, of course, to the Paradiso, the final vision of God, which, of course, three interlocking circles of light. So that the whole form and structure, everything in the poem is in threes. Everything. And it's just the design of the poem is absolutely overwhelming when you realize how he set the thing up. But the other thing he'll do is that as there are corresponding moments in all three sections. If you meet a character at a certain place in the Inferno, you meet a corresponding character at a certain place in the Purgatorio and the Paradiso, and the three reflect against each other. And you suddenly I don't know how he was able to keep it that well organized. Just the organization alone is simply stunning.
Could you comment on the character of Beatrice or Beatrice? I read one Protestant critic who said, well, Dante was in love with this woman and he wasn't in love with his wife and blah blah blah. So she was his muse or whatever. And I don't know. Any thoughts on
it? Yeah. Well, I'll tell you. Let me put it this way. You can't say that she's just one thing, okay? And the other thing is. Yes, he exhibits a devotion. He was married. There's questions about how happy his marriage was. Who knows? Who knows how happy any marriage is, right? Let's put it this way. He remained married to his wife his entire life, and they had children together, and, you know, so it's... But we also know that being married, living a family life, is not inspirational. And Beatrice was, in one regard, his muse, okay? But he first met her when he was 9 years old, and she was 8, okay? Which also suggests, again, a modern critic will say, well, his love for this woman was something quite apart from his love for his wife, and what was really going on here? What was going on? She was 8 years old. Now, today, 9-year-olds may be that demented, because sadly we've ruined their imaginations, but back then that's not the case, and what he saw was an innocence and purity that struck him, and he only saw her one or two additional times in his life before she died at a very early age. She married someone else. We do not find any record of him moaning and weeping because she married another man. That had nothing to do with it. It was a vision. It was a vision of beauty and innocence and purity that gave him a sense of something higher. So that in that sense, she was his muse, she was an inspiration, she was a source of the vision. Let's just call it the vision. And she leads him through the Paradiso, but the fact of the matter is, even that's inaccurate. You read the commentaries, they will say, Virgil leads him through Inferno and the Purgatorio, Beatrice leads him through heaven. Only partially correct. Beatrice leads him up to the final moment when St. Bernard takes over. And it's St. Bernard that unveils the vision of God to him. And by that point, Beatrice has simply taken her seat on one of the petals of the gigantic unfolding white rose that is Dante's vision of heaven, and she becomes one of the communion of saints. And he gives a farewell look to her, but his last vision of her is in the company of all the other saints, and then his vision is directed elsewhere. So there are many other things that she performs many different functions in the poem. She was a real person that meant a great deal to him personally. She was also a poetic inspiration. She was also part of the spiritual vision that allowed him to write the poem, but it all kept leading away from self, always away from self. There's a moment near the end of the Purgatorio where she accuses him. When the trade-off is made and Virgil hands him over to Beatrice, she has a moment where she accuses him of having been unfaithful. Now, it's not an unfaithfulness, it simply means that he became at one moment, and he doesn't define it, too absorbed in worldliness and forgot that spiritual vision, which is why the whole poem clearly begins, as he says, in the middle of my journey, okay? Halfway through, which means 35, he's using the biblical, you know, three score and ten. He's 35, 1300, there it was, boom, middle of his life. And he found himself in the midst of a dark wood. Something's gone wrong. He's lost the vision. He gets to the top of Purgatory and she says to him, "You lost the vision." And he is so ashamed, he passes out. This awful sense of betrayal. But it's a betrayal in a sense of the spiritual vision and what his real journey was supposed to be, which he knew and had neglected, although we don't know the details. We don't know the details. Yes.
Two objections that the society of priests writes. That is, at least, opinion enough, because of that, you know, highly geometric and symbolic composition. Is it true that he has an agnostic influence or not?
Let me put it this way. You can find in the poem everything going on in his age, okay? And insofar as the poem is on one level a reflection of the age, there are some who claim that in terms of strict theology, some peculiar things creep in here and there. It seems to me the great danger with the poem is to read it solely theologically. Because what is happening is the vision is a poetic vision. And it's very specifically that things are being revealed to him. But what most observers neglect or overlook is that all along the way, he is making mistakes in judgment. It's why Virgil keeps reprimanding him. It's why the moment I just mentioned with Beatrice, I mean, it is a severe reprimand. Even as he's going through the Paradiso, she will remind him of little things, but at that point it's done more pleasantly and with good humor. The vision is of a soul constantly making mistakes, because the journey is indeed the journey of a soul to the only moment where I would say we get Dante the soul, as opposed to Dante the poet, Dante the pilgrim, let's call him, Dante the pilgrim, with a full, complete, accurate, truthful vision, is the moment when he sees the Godhead, the three interconnecting circles of light, obviously meant to represent the Trinity. On the second circle is imposed the figure of a man, it's the Son, and he has a moment where he says, "I couldn't understand how that could be. I was seeing the Godhead, in the second ring of light, I was seeing a man, the mystery, finally, the ultimate mystery," and then it comes to him in a flash, and he says, "And I understood, but I can't tell you." The one moment of complete understanding he has, he won't share, the vision being, each soul must make the journey.
So that, yes, there are errors along the way, many of them deliberately built into the poem. Deliberately built into the poem. So you can find ideas flying around that were current. It happens on the philosophical level. It happens on the poetic level. Part of the poem is writing about good and bad poetry. And how do we evaluate it? It happens on the civic level. Part of the poem is about how do you found a city, how do you govern a city. He'd been exiled from Florence. He wrote the poem in exile. In the Paradiso, he meets his great-great-grandfather, Cacciaguida, who tells him, you're going to be exiled. Get ready for it. The bums are going to throw you out. And he's shocked. He's absolutely shocked. He says, this can't be. This can't be. And yet he's already writing the poem in exile, which means he's playing little games like this. But it has to do with often the fallible nature of human understanding or human passion. Right at the beginning, the most famous episode, we're in the Inferno, in the circle of the lustful. Francesca da Rimini flies by with Paolo. She seduces him. She comes on to him, and he falls for it, and he faints dead away. It's a parallel moment with the fainting that occurs when Beatrice confronts him. Hers is a real one. Hers is a spiritual reprimand. Here it is, the soul is seduced by this most seductive of all women. And he's overwhelmed by it, and just boom, out cold. And yet, Virgil, and it's one of those moments where Virgil puts up with him throughout the whole thing, and occasionally gets very angry with him. But at that moment, it's made obvious to us, because there's poor Paolo, that Francesca seduced earlier, who's just tagging along. He doesn't say a word. He's just mournfully, he's united with her forever. He lost his manhood, he lost his life, he lost everything, and he's just tagging along, and she does all the talking, and is quite literally putting the make on Dante the Pilgrim. And it works. And you have the sense of Paolo seeing repeated what he went through that caused his own demise, and now he's in hell. Horrible moment. But my point is, it's poetry. It's poetry. And in being dramatic, epic poetry, in a way, the poem is filled with errors. And many of them errors either of Dante the Pilgrim or the souls that he meets. In the Paradiso, sort of the early spheres of the Paradiso, he meets souls, two women in particular, who had made vows, were in the convent, and then were forcibly removed and made to marry. They broke their vow. Under duress, they had a chance to go back later, didn't. And there's a sense of they know what they should have done, they did wrong. They're still in paradise. They're still in paradise. Very controversial little moment. Much commentary about this. But there again, part of what he's doing is building in, for the sake of the structure of the poem, a parallel moment with the souls in limbo in the Inferno, the souls in the anti-purgatory, and these souls who are in paradise, but sort of in the lowest level, who didn't follow through in the fullness of what they might have done. And part of that, I think, has more to do with the structure of the poem than Dante's theology. It's the danger of judging poetry theologically.
The first circle of hell, that's like almost like a natural paradise, or that's where Virgil and
right.
Aristotle.
That's right.
And Solzhenitsyn used that as
the first circle, exactly. His greatest novel. It's a wonderful novel. I don't know if you know the correspondence. The reason Solzhenitsyn calls his novel the first circle, of hell is quite comfortable. It's the place where all those Dante loved those classical figures. He knew they had to be in hell. So he creates this first circle, and it's really comfortable. Although he's not a sentimentalist, because at one point Virgil is asked, "Well, what do you do there?" And Virgil says, "We spend our time sighing and weeping." They live with the awareness somehow that they missed out. They haven't been given the fullness of vision. And Virgil even describes the harrowing of hell, but he describes it as this hero who came and led some out, but the rest of us stayed. He can't comprehend the fullness of who Christ is. And again, hence he's there. But it's pretty comfortable. You know, there are no tortures, there are no torments. It's quite comfortable. Solzhenitsyn uses it for those scientists and mathematicians that the communists had put in the gulag, but they needed their brains, so they put them in rather comfortable little places to live. Because they needed them to work, which means they had to have their brains, they had to be healthy, they had to have some food, they had to have their laboratories, they needed blackboards and chalk, and he calls it the first circle. They're in limbo. They're pretty close to hell. But it ain't bad compared to what all the others are going through. Yeah. It's, yeah, Dante is often called Aquinas in verse. Yeah. It's not totally fair. It's loaded with ideas, clearly, because coming just after Aquinas, and Dante had enormous respect for Aquinas, so that the material comes in over and over again throughout the poem. And indeed, in the Paradiso, Aquinas himself appears, yeah, and tells the story of the life of St. Francis, which is quite interesting. It's not quite fair. It's not quite fair. Dante is Dante in verse, is the Divine Comedy in verse. Again, it's a huge influence. It's a huge influence. But it's something different. It's so very different, I don't think it's fair to the poem to put it that way. Yeah. It is, to my mind, it is a synthesis of vision. It's the putting together of so many diverse strands. It's nearly overwhelming. It's something that poetry can do. But again, the greatness of the poem is that Dante came up with a means of representing everything he knew and thought about the world around him and the next. And in a way, it's the reason the poem on one level is overwhelming. It's a theological poem. It's a political poem. It's a poetic poem. It's a personal poem. It's attacks on his enemies. My goodness. Oh, Pope Boniface VIII. Oh, man. We get to the Paradiso. He meets St. Peter. He's being grilled by St. Peter. He's given three examinations before he can go into the Imperium. And the first on faith is from St. Peter. And he passes with flying colors. And then St. Peter looks down on the earth and just rails against Boniface VIII. And it's fascinating, the phrase he uses, he looks down, he says, "The seat is vacant." And of course, he's speaking metaphorically. And then he says, "And Rome has become a running sewer." And St. Peter just rails against these popes who are running the church. And I'm not kidding, reading through it this time, it was this sense of, my goodness, we're mild and polite now. It's not just the invective that gets hurled, but Dante puts it in the mouth of St. Peter. It's simply incredible. But he'll do that in terms of theology. He gets back at everyone. They're personal enemies. Well, it's a wonderful system. You're writing a poem about the inferno. Just fling your enemies into it. And then give commentary on it. Although, again, he's not a sentimentalist. One of the most overwhelming moments is in the 15th canto when he meets Bruno Latini, one of his teachers. Great poet for whom he had enormous respect. And it's the circle of the sodomites. And suddenly he feels a hand touch the hand. They're running on burning sand while fire falls from the sky on them. And suddenly he feels this hand touch his garment and say, "How wonderful." And he looks down and he says, "You here, Ser Brunetto." And there's this awkward pause. It's heartbreaking. And they speak for a while, and then he sees him. Latini says, I have to catch up with the others. I cannot stay. And his last vision of him is running on the burning sand, catching up with the other damned souls. The last line of the canto in the Musa translation. But he was like the winner of that race, not the last one in. It's just heartbreaking. It's just heartbreaking. But he puts him there. Boom. You know? He's down there. He won't sentimentalize. He has great respect for the man as a poet, but he's... boom. Yes, he does. Yes, he does. And in fact, interestingly enough, in the second part of Little Gidding, the last of the four quartets, Eliot is walking... The vision is Eliot, who was an air raid warden during the Second World War, walking the streets at night. Everyone is in bomb shelters. And he suddenly meets, as he calls it, a compound familiar ghost. And he encounters this figure and says, "You here? You know, what are you doing walking the streets of London during the blackout?" And Eliot, we never find out who it is. Some claim it's Dante. Some claim it's we don't know for certain. And there's this conversation with this figure from Eliot's past who prophesies and talks to him about what he is going to face. And it's someone that Eliot has enormous respect for, who's dead, who's come back with a harsh message. And you suddenly it's Eliot using Dante, but in a completely modern context. But instead of ending with an equivalent of that line, that little section of Little Gidding ends with, he sees him walk away, and then says that the figure went away and faded on the blowing of the horn. And suddenly it's the all clear, and everyone comes out, and the figure is vanished. He uses the Dante image from that canto of the Inferno, but the last line, "and faded on the blowing of the horn," is the ghost from Hamlet who disappears and faded at the crowing of the cock. And he uses the same rhythm, the same sounds, and suddenly we get a little bit of... In structuring the poem, Eliot first tips his hat to Dante, and then at the end tips his hat to Shakespeare by echoing a line. But it's that sense of tradition, learning from the past, using the past, but transforming it into something that's completely his own. You can read that section of the poem and have no idea of the Dante influence, the Shakespeare influence. They're just buried there for anybody who can discover it. Yes, and I can't remember exactly where. I think he uses it as an epigraph, but I don't remember where it comes up. Yeah. He quotes so much Dante. I mean, he uses it everywhere. It's in Prufrock, it's in The Wasteland, it's in Ash Wednesday, four quartets. He loved Dante and knew Dante backward and forward. Yes.
So for you, as a general question before you, would you put any hierarchical order as to what's more important between words, rhyme, and rhythm?
It's all one. It's all one. And well, in terms of translation.
Trying to make verse from originals is not as good as going for the exact meaning of the words and putting it in prose.
Translating prose is difficult. Translating poetry is impossible. And yet they're both noble efforts. I read a thing by an essay by a translator who translated the Russians into English, mainly Dostoevsky, and said that for any translator to render one work from another is like taking Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and trying to play it on a tin can. But it's impossible. What can you do? And yet, it's a verse translation. He doesn't attempt to rhyme, which means he's going for accuracy of meaning. But within that, what he does do is occasionally give you a sense of some of the rhythm or the meaning. Okay. It's a very difficult thing to do. There's a little line he gives an example. I can't give the full line in Italian. It's the moment again in the circle of the lustful. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, that's all right. I'm looking for the
this will do nicely. It's the moment when Cleopatra goes flying by. She's in the it's in Canto 5. She's in the circle, the second circle with the rest of the lustful, and she just goes flashing by in an instant. And here, and the line is in Italian: "Poi Cleopatra lusurioso." And then Cleopatra, filled with lechery, filled with lustfulness. Okay. Now, if you get the original, which it's a very simple line. Poi a, next is, then comes Cleopatras, and then comes, next is Cleopatra, and then one long word, lusuriosa, which in Italian is that sense of, you know, filled with lust. Musa renders it, and it's wonderful. And next came Cleopatra, who loved men's lusting. Now, what he does is give us the rhythm of the original line, which starts out, poi Cleopatras lusurioso. The vowels stretch out, the line slows down, and the word is voluptuous, lusurioso. Just, whoa, the word tells you all you need to know about the woman. It's all in the sound of that word, okay? Musa tries to give us an equivalent. He puts it at the end of the line, and then came Cleopatra, who loved men's lusting. And he gives us all those L sounds, okay? And he gives us a little equivalent, which is, you know, it's not exact, but it gives you a little sense of how the original line is working, which suggests to me not just great care, because it gives you the meaning, but more than that, the man has an ear. The man has caught the music of it. It's not exact, but we're getting a hint of the music. Just a hint of what the sounds are like and how they're working. And even if you can get a little of that, it's helpful. It gives you some, you know. I was talking to Father Fullerton's sister this afternoon, who said that she when she was studying in France, she had to read Shakespeare in French. And, you know, it's just, it's one of those things. I mean, how can you do it? The man is his words. You translate it into a different language, you lose the beauty, the rich, the music. Poetry is music. Poetry is half music. And the music and the meaning are absolutely one, absolutely united. So it's incredibly difficult to do any translation, but an honorable effort. Then you settle. No, exactly. Then you have to settle. Then you read it as best you can. Yeah. Then you must.
I know that not many people in France would read Shakespeare.
That's right. That's right.
It's impossible.
No, many in France wouldn't want to. You know, Voltaire called Shakespeare le barbare, the barbarian. Yeah, Voltaire just thought Shakespeare was a despicable writer. And many of the French have that. Shakespeare's strengths are so antithetical to the whole French vision of what literary art should be. They find him just, you know, just a barbaric Englishman. Yes, yes. Well, I said it would be informal. It was. It's just little odds and ends. I would love to get into the poem in greater detail, because it is an extraordinary piece of work. But if you get a chance, I think you're stopping at Ravenna this summer. Dante's tomb is in Ravenna. He lived his last years in Ravenna. The poem was finished there. He completed the Paradiso there. Interestingly enough, at his death, the last 10 cantos were gone. They had no idea where they were. And they knew he had finished the poem. They simply couldn't locate the last 10 cantos. One of his sons had a dream. And in the dream, the father came and said, "Look here, it's a little thing in the wall. I put it there. It's behind a curtain." They went there, and there it was. There it was. So, yeah. Ravenna was... He never got back to Florence after being exiled in 1302. Spent 10 years and wrote the whole poem in exile, always longing to get back to Florence, but he never returned, and died in Ravenna. and is indeed buried there. Yes. But don't be afraid. Read the poem. Read the poem.
I'm just wondering if you could give some comments on how you usually read something like Dante, Shakespeare. Do you look for structure first?
No. First time through. You're reading for meaning. I mean, really, just what's going on here? What's happening here? What's going on? Part of the problem is the assumption is first time through you can get it all. Nonsense. It's the first time you visit a large city where you haven't been before, you go and see the high points and sort of try to get a sense of wait, what's where, and it's what you do the first time through a great literary work. Which means you read it first of all for story. What's happening here? Where do we start? What happens next? What comes next? Where does it go? Where does it end up? The through line. And along the way you may notice some other things, but first time through it's simply to begin to try to get a sense of what's going on. Yeah. In all honesty, I teach Shakespeare, and by that I mean I know Shakespeare fairly intimately. It's out of 30 years of study, 30 plus years of study. It keeps unfolding, it gets richer and richer, but when students say to me, well, what do I do? I'm reading this for the first time. My answer is, hey, it's a story. It's a great story, first time through. You just read for the story. Who are these people? What's going on here? It's absolutely true of this. Part of the problem, it's an enormous cast of characters, you know. But it's the same way as you go somewhere and you're suddenly introduced to all kinds of people. Well, you're getting quick impressions first time through. Well, that's what you're doing, yeah.
So at the very beginning, he speaks of the leopard and the she-wolf and all these things that are obviously symbolic.
Yes.
In
a sense, again, what you find is the nice thing about the Musa volume is he sort of gives you quick, straightforward commentary. Okay. And simply, what Musa does is simply assigns each one of the animals to one of the circles of the Inferno, one set of sins. Okay. But look, on a simpler level, minus commentary, you pick up something without commentary. He comes up against the leopard, the she-wolf. We don't know the specifics, but you can. It's very different from coming upon a peacock, a pussycat, and a canary. He is using something that we should have immediate, visceral reactions to. You come upon a leopard, and you know what the reaction is going to be. What do I know about leopards? I know spots, stains. There's something, okay. Just on the most basic, a poet will work that way. A poet's going to work on the most basic level with our most basic associations. So it's not a matter of saying, now, what specific sins does the leopard stand for? The leopard's dangerous, the leopard will eat you, and the leopard has spots. Okay, on I go. And you don't need commentary in order to do that. If you get that much, you're well on your way to understanding why he put the leopard there. The final vision of paradise, a white rose. Why a rose? Well, you know, it's absolutely. I mean, in one sense, we know that. Let's assume some poor benighted youngster who's been raised without faith, who's reading the Paradiso and comes upon the white rose. White, purity. The rose, springtime, beauty, unfolding, opening up, okay? Someone without faith, without knowing anything about the Catholic faith, anything about paradise, anything about those theological connections, can look at the white rose and still get some of the basics. Just on if, but that's the other reason that young people have to be brought up out in the world of nature. Because you, if you're brought up watching Mr. Ed reruns, you're gonna, you know, a rose. What's a rose? I don't know. Is it a bird? I've never seen one. A leopard? What's a leopard? I don't know. Kind of car?
if you remove them from nature and you're removing them from the most basic knowledge that can allow you to read these things. Again, that's why I'm saying it's part of the game we play that we immediately have to have all the meaning. Nonsense. You just on the most human level, you know what a rose is. You come to the souls that are in the river of blood, or as I said, the sodomites running on hot burning sand with fire falling on it. You don't need commentary. it's absolutely clear. It's absolutely clear. And part of the strength of the poem, and part of the reason he's a great poet, is he gives you those strong, striking images. What's fascinating is the change in the images. One reason people read the Inferno is that the images are more striking. The punishments are more striking. The forest of the suicides, where they have become trees, and as he walks by and breaks the branches off, it oozes out. And the suicides are going to be perpetually dying. That's a horrifying image. It's more shocking than in the Purgatorio when he comes upon the souls who were the prideful, who have these enormous stones on their back, and they're singing. They're singing to the glory of God, walking over, bent over with these stones on their back. That's nice. I mean, that's good. It's a wonderful image, but it's not as striking as the suicide, okay? The Inferno is more fantastic in terms of the imagination. Until finally we get to the Paradiso and the images keep moving in and out of each other. Because the Inferno moves towards stasis. We get to the bottom and Satan is frozen in ice, munching on Judas, Brutus, and Cassius with his wings just going up and down mechanically. It's mechanistic, it's immobile. The final vision of the pit of hell is mechanistic and immobile. We move higher up into the Paradiso and it's just blinding light that's constantly swirling. It's just constant motion and more brilliance. Just overwhelming. And there is, again, because it's paradise, it is all one. It is not as specified. The damned souls can't break out of themselves and hence are trapped within their own punishment. Those souls that are in paradise have a common vision, are part of the communion of saints, and there's this constant movement and they share things. Things are shared. And yet the variety he's able to bring to that is just incredible. In some ways it's more imaginative. It's more imaginative. But you respond in the same way. A gigantic cross made up of the souls, and the lights are just darting up and down in every direction on this cross that's before me. Wow. Overwhelming. Glorious, glorious images. It's wonderful stuff.